The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. It's November 6th and I'm not here.
What do you mean you're not here?
Hi, Tim. I'm Diane Lees, the host of the show, along with Tim McKenna. What do you mean, what do I mean? I'm in Philadelphia, remember?
Of course.
Yeah, at the Philly Bike Expo. If you're in the neighborhood tomorrow, why don't you stop by the expo? Our booth number, I got that ahead this time, 6015.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's at the Philadelphia Convention Center. Mosey on over and say hello. Sunday hours are 10 to 5. There's free indoor bike parking.
Yep.
Evidently, there's going to be food trucks.
Tater tots, I heard.
Tater tots. Oh, yeah, you did hear that, didn't you? Well, I imagine there'll be some Philly cheesesteak. What do you think?
Yes.
Yeah, probably. I want to move on to this week's show because we have a really cool first topic.
Which one are we doing first?
Do you like beer?
Well, occasionally.
You're not a huge beer fan.
No, but beer is good.
Beer is good. Well, I was sort of thinking about topics for the show that might pertain to the holidays, and I'm staring at my computer, and I said to myself, cyclists like beer.
Yes, they do.
So I type into the old Google thingy, beer connoisseur. What do you think comes up?
I'm afraid to ask when you Google things.
How about the magazine, Beer Connoisseur?
That's perfect.
So I contacted them, and I said, I would like to talk to you about beer on my radio show, which is about bicycling, because cyclists love beer, right?
Yes.
Right. And I get this lovely email back from a guy named Jonathan Ingram. And Jonathan is the managing editor of Beer Connoisseur magazine. Ba-dum-bum.
There we go.
So he is our first guest tonight. I have to say that beer is an acquired taste, in my humble opinion. Mine is, my acquired taste is not too broad, not too deep. They're, you know, after a hot afternoon, like riding or cutting the grass, a nice cold beer is nice. I am also going to give you a recipe.
I love recipes.
Okay. So, you know, I shop at Whole Paycheck, as we call it, Whole Foods.
Yes.
Which, by the way, I don't care what anybody says, I like Whole Foods. It's a mile from our house. It's about the only place I shop. And I'm friends with the guy behind the fish counter, right?
Mm-hmm.
His name is Elliot. And he knows everything there is to know about fish. He also knows how to season things. And I let him season our food, you know, and then I take it home and cook it. So I told him we were going to do this piece on beer. He also rides his bike everywhere. He doesn't have a car. So Elliot's really my cool guy at Whole Foods. All right. So he tells me I have the best sauce recipe for any kind of fish or chicken. And you can put it on meat, you know, ribs and stuff like that. It's my bachelor sauce. I'm like, okay, what does that mean? Starts with beer.
Of course.
He uses stout that's flat. He adds a little bit of chopped garlic, soy sauce and honey, and he says you cook it down until it's real thick and slather it on and cook your food.
That sounds like something that's great to put on ribs, and I guess you're right, just about everything
else.
Just
about everything. He says it's really, really good. I haven't tried it yet because I just found out about it yesterday when he seasoned our fish.
We've had enough guests in the past that are chefs in their daily life, so
right. Maybe
we should pass it on to one of them and see what they think.
Okay? I think so. So we are going to talk with Jonathan Ingram. He's going to offer up some news about the holiday beers, whether beer is actually good for you or not, and whether beer might be harmful in some way. He actually knows all this stuff because he's the beer connoisseur.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So after we talk with Jonathan and we do some of our news, we're going to take a break and we're going to come back and speak with the amazing Rebecca Rush.
Queen of Pain?
Queen of Pain. That is her nickname. But she isn't the biggest, she isn't the strongest, or even the fastest. Rebecca Rush is the grittiest and most determined athlete on the endurance athlete scale by any and every measure that I can come up with. Now, at the age of 45, she's conquered what it might take multiple lifetimes for other people. I could never do what she's done. She's just done so many things. We'll talk with her about her days of insecurity, her failures, her triumphs. She has a new book, Rush to Glory, Risk and Triumph on the Path Less Traveled. It's out on Velo Press. It might be just the inspiration you need to push yourself to the next level. I think it's going to be a great interview. Time's a-wasting. Let's head on down to Atlanta and learn all about beer with Jonathan Ingram of Beer Connoisseur Magazine. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for speaking with me today.
Well, thanks for the invitation, Diane.
You're welcome. And I assume you're drinking a beer?
I am. I'm drinking a smoked porter from Newport Storm in Rhode Island.
Nice. Well, I thought we'd give our listeners a little bit of a break from our usual conversations, you know, racing and training and commuting, and talk about a subject that's pretty near and dear to all cyclists' hearts, beer. So I know that beer is old, like as old as humankind, and there are lots of microbreweries today. We have a lot of good ones here in Northeast Ohio. There are home brewers, many choices. So I thought I need to check in with a professional because I don't know a lot about beer. Tell us a little bit about Jonathan and Beer Connoisseur, your magazine.
Well, I should say that I'm the managing editor of the Beer Connoisseur, which has been published for 5 years from Atlanta. And prior to joining the Beer Connoisseur, I was a freelance writer for about 30 years, and I wrote a lot about motor racing and cars. But I often thought that I should have a T-shirt that says, I write for beer. Because at the end of the day, that's what I really enjoyed doing was after writing was enjoying some beer with friends. Also, I'm a runner, so after running, a beer is also quite good. So, you know, we have been part of the craft beer explosion, I suppose. You know, now that I write about beer every day, it's probably the perfect job.
Yeah, no kidding. I think I have the perfect job, but I imagine if I was a real avid beer enthusiast, your job would be the perfect job. So is the magazine print as well as online, or is it strictly online?
We are published quarterly as a magazine, and yes, you can get content from us, a wealth of content at beerconnoisseur.com.
As long as you know how to spell connoisseur, you're good. No, I'm kidding. I wanted to talk about beer now because the holidays are coming, and almost all these small breweries come out with what is known as their Christmas beer, Christmas ale, whatever it is. So I thought we'd start with that. And we're in Northeast Ohio, but, you know, our show's heard all over the world. So I imagine you know of lots of Christmas beers?
Well, I think the answer to that is yes, and also a lot of breweries do what would be called a winter seasonal, something that matches up to the weather that one would generally find in North America during the winter months. So in addition to Christmas ales and beers, most of the brewers, almost all of them, in fact, do something that's matches up well with the winter season. So in the Beer Connoisseur, we actually, in each issue, we do something about the beers of that particular season. So if you like, we can talk about some of not only Christmas ales, winter seasonals, and what we call winter warmers.
Sure. You know, Christmas is coming. It's fourth quarter here in North America. I imagine that in the Southern Hemisphere, it's a whole different thing. But yeah, tell us a little bit about what you found that people are drinking right now and that seem to be interesting beers.
Well, I'm all in favor of personal warming. And that's a good thing about some of the winter styles is they generally have a fairly high alcohol by volume. And winter warmers are the type of beer that have what we designate as 7% alcohol by volume and up. So I can tell you that one of the leading brews in that category that we look forward to every year at this time is made by Anchor Brewing, and it's called Old Foghorn. And that is an American-style barley wine. And barley wine is sort of self-explanatory. It's made with barley malt, like most beers, and it has a high ABV, and therefore it's kind of like a barley wine. So that was one of the, Anchor Brewing's one of the founding members of the craft brewing movement in the U.S. It was started in the 1960s. So it helped introduce a lot of people in the U.S. to kind of a lost art, which was barley wine.
And where is Anchor Brewing from? Where are they out of?
Anchor Brewing is located in San Francisco.
Well, sort of an anchor. That makes sense.
Yeah. So another one, if we, in the winter seasonal category, which would be something that sort of matches up with the weather but doesn't have quite as much alcohol by volume, at the top of the list is another one that's kind of from out west, I should say, Alaskan Brewing Company's smoked porter. And that's probably one of the, in the opinion of most people, or many beer drinkers, I should say, one of the more flavorful smoked beers made in the U.S.
Okay, so what do you mean by smoked?
Well, in smoked, it means that the malt, which is the starting point of beer, is smoked in a smokehouse or some sort of kiln-type situation, so that somewhat like, say, putting any type of meat or fish on the barbecue above coals. Basically, you impart the smoke flavor to the malt, and then you begin the brewing process, which, of course, you end up cooking the malt and then taking the fluid that results from that, and you begin the brewing process with yeast that helps produce alcohol.
How long does it take to make, let's say, one of these porters? And then I want to ask you something about the definition of a couple of these beers. But how long does it take to actually, from start to finish, make a batch of beer, if that's the way you know, couch it?
Well, generally, you can make the beer in one morning if you have all the ingredients right there. In other words, the malt has already been kilned and is ready to go into the water for the mash, and then the cooking process, and then you transfer it to the storage facility for pitching the yeast, which then begins the fermentation process, and then you so that generally you can do that in a morning with not a huge volume of beer. The key thing is the time after that that you would, fermenting the beer often takes several days, but then it's a matter of aging the beer in various types of tanks, and so that can, generally rule of thumb would be 3 months, something like that. You could do it in less, and certainly there are a lot of beers, if you age them for a year, they come out a lot better.
I am speaking with Jonathan Ingram. He is the managing editor of Beer Connoisseur magazine. So if you want to know about beer, he's the guy. That's so cool. So, cyclists eat anything, M&Ms, Cliff Bars, all kinds of stuff. Is beer healthy?
Beer is healthy in moderation. Beware of a sample of one, but I try to drink 4 beers a day, but a big caveat, that is 4 ounces of 4 different beers, so I drink 16 ounces, and that's a pint, and everybody thinks, well, a pint is just a starting point. And that would be a good starting point for sure. But beer in moderation, up to, say, the general rule of thumb is 2 beers, depending on your height and body weight, is healthy. Beyond that, you begin to get a declining benefit from beer. So that's a general rule of thumb.
Wow. I'm sure there are people sitting there going, wow, that 12-pack I pounded last weekend probably wasn't a good idea.
Maybe not. We all like to maybe have more than a pint or two on occasion. But I would say as guidelines, you know, there are proven reasons for why you would want to drink in moderation. The moderation, there are flavonoids in beer. It's a heart-healthy compound that counters cell damage and reduces risk of heart disease and cancer, just flavonoids in general. So also ethanol, alcohol, generally helps lower the LDL or bad cholesterol, and it helps increase HDL cholesterol. And, you know, there's soluble fiber in beer, which contributes to better lipid profile, which is another important blood ingredient. I should hasten to add that, you know, I'm a runner, so when I started running due to a back problem in my 40s, suddenly my LDL went, not suddenly, but over time, the LDL went much further down,
sure.
And the HDL, the good stuff, went much further up. So a much better combination, and something I'm sure we want to talk about, is regular exercise does a lot more for heart health. And then moderate beer afterwards can also be a benefit.
Sure. Tell me about temperature in beer. I like beer really, really cold. I know in Europe people drink warm beer. I just can't even – somehow it just doesn't work for me. But tell me why you would drink a beer cold as opposed to warm.
Well, it's a little bit like the whole brewing process. There are different approaches to every – type of beer, and warm beer is kind of a relative term. You know, it's cold beer, we would think in the U.S. is generally 35 to 40 degrees Fahrenheit. You know, an ideal temperature for a lot of beers that are produced in Europe, in other words, a temperature that helps bring out the flavor of the beer and helps you more or less taste the flavor better, might be closer to, say, 55 degrees or 50 to 55 degrees. So, you know, 35 to 40 is a lot different from 50 to 55, but you know, so it's a relative term in if you want to talk about warm beers. It's closer to a warmer beer or not an ice cold beer.
I see. Well, that makes some sense. So tell me about things like mixing beers, black and golds, black and tans, people who might take two different beers and pour them into the same glass and drink them. What happens to the individual beers? What happens when you get two together?
Well, I think that's a bid for increased flavor. I know I survived the 1980s on what's called a black and tan.
Right. Guinness and...
And an ale, a good strong or well-bodied, I should say.
Here we do black and golds, which is Guinness and Dortmunder.
I would love to try that.
Well, come on up.
unfortunately, here in Georgia, we don't get the Dortmunder style on tap. And it's a combination, I'm sure, is best when you get it on tap. We don't find it in the stores too often. The heritage in the Midwest, particularly the German heritage, is coming through there, I think, when you are able to access those type of beers, alt beers and all the other styles of beer, Kolsch, that are popular in Germany but not as popular in the U.S. The Bavarian styles, of course, are pretty popular everywhere.
Right, right. If you had to, like, line up your top three beers... Can you do that? What would they be?
Well, I suppose that it would be politic of me to say my top favorite styles as opposed to beer companies.
Probably.
You know, I think that's fair because I don't know about you. Maybe you can answer this question. But when I go to the beer store, I'm always deciding what style of beer am I looking for. And then even if I decide on the style, I sort of say, well, which one of the brewers that makes that style am I in the mood for now?
That's the way my partner does it. Yes, that's exactly how he approaches beer. Me, give me a Dortmunder. I'm a one-horse pony. I'm a one-trick pony when it comes to that stuff, unfortunately.
Well, but you, the black and gold doesn't necessarily appeal to you? Or?
No, no, that's Brian, too. He likes a strong flavor.
Yeah, yeah, Guinness is pretty incredible beer in the sense that it's a strong flavor, but it's pretty approachable, and it's got a little bit of bitterness, but not too much, and it's dark, but it's also refreshing. It's pretty universal, so let's go there.
Okay.
Guinness would certainly be one of my favorite styles for the reasons I just mentioned.
Sure.
And then Guinness actually began as a different style, the porter, which is the one I'm drinking this evening, albeit it's a smoked porter, but nevertheless a porter. And that style became most popular started in the 1700s in London near the docks, where there were a lot of porters that would have to unload the ships that actually came right into the heart of London and the wharves there. And the porters liked beers that were a little bit stronger and had more body to them. And the way the clever brewers at that time achieved it was if they had beer that was a little bit stale, that was not entirely fresh, they mixed it or blended it with fresher beer, and you ended up with a brown beer that was brown beer is a typical style in England, but you ended up with a brown beer that was a little bit stronger and had a sort of almost a touch of a sweet malty taste, because if you take a beer glass that's been empty for a while and you give it a sniff, it actually has kind of a sweet aroma to it. So that was the origin of porter, and the dock workers liked that a lot. It was often served in the mornings because they were finished work at mid morning to noon, and so that would be one of my other favorite styles, porter. And then the Irish got a hold of that, and it became Guinness. So I would say that's my those are two styles, and a third style would be California Common, which is a steam beer. So that's a hybrid type beer, which is made with different types of yeast that are then, I should say, a lager yeast that is then produced much like an ale would be produced, fermented like an ale. So, and I can give you an example of that. Anchor Steam beer is the most popular.
Wow, there's a lot to know about beer. I know a lot about bicycling, but I sure don't know a lot about beer. But I know a lot more than I did about 15 minutes ago. That's really cool.
I think that it can be like stamp collecting or running or cycling, in the sense that the more you know about it, the more engaging it becomes, and the more interesting. Or wine is there's a lot of smaller distilleries, craft distilleries.
Sure.
Popping up.
Oh, yeah.
Spirits. Yeah. Spirits would be another category, or people are really learning more about food these days. So I think it's a lot like all those different hobbies or things that engage people. The more you know about it, the more fun it is, and the more you can enjoy it.
Well, I certainly appreciate you taking time to talk to our listeners about beer, because I know most of them are beer drinkers, and knowing more about what you're putting into you from that perspective is a good idea. Once again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Ingram. He is the managing editor of Beer Connoisseur, and it's beerconnoisseur.com online. Thanks so much for talking with me this evening.
Well, I've enjoyed it, Diane, and happy and healthy beer drinking to you and all your listeners. I know there's a lot of cyclists out there, so it's a good recovery drink when you're cycling. To have a couple beers, it gives you some of the replenishment that you need after exercise.
I think they found that out all on their own. Thanks so much, Jonathan. Have a great holiday.
Thank you, Diane.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Jonathan Ingram joined me from his home in Atlanta.
We're spoiled in Cleveland with Great Lakes, with Market Garden Brewery, with Rocky River, Nano Brew, and all of the local breweries that we've known for years.
Yeah. You know, I just thought that this would be a really different and interesting conversation. That was fun.
And it's a nice, as he said, it's a nice recovery drink.
It is indeed.
Don't always have to drink chocolate milk.
No, we don't. We are going to take a real quick break on the Outspoken Cyclist, and we'll be back with some news. drinking beer, are you?
No, but I'm wondering if maybe we should sometime and see if the show's affected in any way.
We're back on the Outspoken Cyclist. We're still talking about beer here behind the microphone. But we are going to do some news. We have time for a little bit of news. What you got, Mr. Tim?
Just last week, we had the one-hour record that was sent by Mr. Brundley and his team, IAM, is going to change from their professional continental status, and they're going to step up and be part of the UCI World Tour in 2015. And that brings the number of teams up to 18, which is a good thing because we went through.
Yeah, it was like down to 15.
We were down at 15, and then we still have one team that's we're not sure what's going to happen with sanctions and all of that. So good to see that they've stepped up, and it looks like 2015 will be a good year.
So I have a very strange one. This is from mybikemagazine.com. And it is about the Great American Bicycle Tour of 1975.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Although it's a bit grainy and the music is a bit sappy, it's a 14-minute video. It actually doesn't have any speaking.
Sometimes that can be best.
In 1975, J.C. Penney hired 12 college students to ride their bikes from New York City to San Francisco. They were promoting their new disc brake-equipped bikes, OEM'd from Huffy. As you see, if you watch it, they thought people rode bikes in tennis gear. The music is classic. Riding gear was whatever you had. No gloves, no helmets, no worries. So it is mybikemagazine.com, Great American Bicycle Tour 1975. It is worth a take a look just for the hoot factor.
Right. I've seen it. And I don't know that it would have done very much in today's day and age of social media.
No.
So from Cycling Weekly in the UK, Mauro Santambrogio.
Yes.
I've learned not to cheat.
You have to be taught not to cheat?
That's what I just don't understand.
I think it's the opposite. You get taught to cheat.
Right. He says that he's reformed after testing positive for EPO at last year, 2013's, the Giro d'Italia. And he's learned that he's not going to do that anymore.
So
I'm confused as to...
Anyway. All right, we'll get rid of your confusion. Remember our friend Jody Zernanen down in Columbus?
Yes.
Well, she went before city council this week.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, she said, and I will quote, I offered testimony before city council on Monday when they voted for $4 million to build the 2.9 miles of the trail that is in the city of Columbus. The total trail length will be 15 miles. The rest is being built by Metro Parks. The trail is currently half done. The Columbus Dispatch did a story that they approved funding to finish the trail, and Jody had a part in that. So, Jody, you did a good job.
While we're talking about Jody, on Tuesday she was at the Ohio Department of Transportation Pedestrian and Bike Summit. And we actually have a link that we posted up on the Twitter, and we'll see if we can get it on our other pages as well, of the slides from all of the presenters. And it's really interesting to see the slides that show us all of the different options that we have when it comes to bike lane and bike safety and everything else that goes with that. But it's good to see that Ohio is looking forward in this.
My last one is from Velo News Analysis, Why Cycling Needs to Improve Its TV Product. So one of the biggest complaints is they're gone. You know, you saw them for a tenth of a second. And cycling, while it's very exciting for the people who ride, may or may not be exciting for the people, certainly in the U.S., who are very impatient and who want to see blood and guts and all of that. And they want to see it all the time. Take football, for example. That would be a good example. They suggested five simple ways to make cycling more compelling on TV. Graphics. That you can use graphics. There are many ways to tell a story with on-screen graphics, and cycling needs to catch up. The simple use of tickers and graphic boxes could go a long way. GPS technology. UCI finally began this season to experiment with GPS. It's imperfect and sometimes inexact, but it does provide critical information for viewers. Permanent numbers, which I think is a very interesting idea, that the rider always has the same number. Well, duh. I don't know if it was Peter. They say, I don't know if it was Peter Stettin's original idea, but I heard the BMC racing rider talking about it this season. It makes perfect sense. Instead of random numbers plucked from a hat or based on some inane ranking system, give riders a permanent number to be placed on their jerseys, a la the king, right?
Right.
Right. Okay. In race, cameras and audio, like GPS, a sport started to experiment with both of these throughout the season with stunning success. Some of the most compelling video came from Shimano's bike-mounted camera footage of giant Shimano sprinter John Degenkolb and his lead out train during stage 5 at the Tour de Suisse. Everyone who watched that video came away impressed not only with the speeds, bike handling skills in danger, but just how cool it was to be inside the peloton. And then get TV producers who know the sport. I think this is probably one of the most important, in my opinion, that you have people who understand the sport who are producing it. You know, that they're not just saying, oh, well, it's like basketball or it's like football, because it's not. It's such a different kind of a sport. So I think those are 5 really good ideas.
The other thing that we have to look at is that obviously the technology is out there now with the cameras that we have and everything else. I'm sure when they shot the video of that in 1975 with J.C. Penney, they were carrying these big, huge cameras to follow along.
Right.
Now with all of the helmet-mounted, bicycle-mounted, and everything else, it's easy enough to stream so much of this information.
Exactly.
And so many of the times we get stuck with being able to watch a one-hour TV show about it. I'd love to see so much more streamed live. And you look at all of the cyclocross. I think they're doing a great job with everything that we can see now. So it's only going to get better.
Well, I don't have anything else. You had one more, as I remember.
One real quick thing that was really popular on Twitter on Thursday was a BBC poll found that 9 in 10 people support a ban on cyclists wearing headphones while riding.
Why do cyclists wear headphones when riding to begin with? It doesn't make any sense to me.
No, it doesn't, but that was rather popular. But the last one, and on a sad note, and I'm sure everyone has heard by now, Tom Migliozzi from Car Talk passed away in 2002. He posted an article that said he preferred bikes to cars.
Well, on that note, we're
going
to take a break, and we'll be back to talk with the Queen of Pain, Rebecca Rush. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
And we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We are heading out to Ketchum, Idaho. I've never been there.
Neither have I.
And we are going to speak with Rebecca Rush. Rebecca, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
How's it going?
It is a gorgeous day here in Cleveland, and I don't expect it to last very long. How is it in Ketchum, Idaho?
You know, winter's coming pretty quickly, so
yeah.
It's that shoulder season where it's cold and waiting on the snow now.
But you ski. I don't.
I do, yeah. So when you have to get outside in the winter if you're going to live in the mountains here.
I guess so. Well, we don't have mountains, so I don't actually think about it. I discovered some interesting things when I was reading your book, and your new book, Rush to Glory, Adventure, Risk, and Triumph on the Path Less Traveled. It seems that you're so comfortable just blazing your own trail, but you didn't actually start out that way.
Well, I've always been, I guess, gone a little off the beaten path, even in school. You know, I camped in the backyard as a kid and really loved our camping trips, you know, growing up in suburban Chicago. So, I think even as a little kid, I had sort of the wanderlust and, you know, kind of born with that, I think.
Perhaps. Well, your life didn't start out too fabulous. You lost your dad very early.
Mm-hmm.
He was a pilot, evidently, in Vietnam.
Yeah, that's right. And I was 2 or 3 years old, so I don't have any personal memories of him. So, you know, all of that history is pieced together through family members and grandparents and my mom kind of telling me what he was like. But from what I know, he loved to travel too and, you know, lived out of his car for a little while and definitely was an adventurous spirit as well.
And as we start winding down to the end of this interview, we're going to sort of wrap it all around to maybe finding out a little more about him or at least about the life he led. I'd like to know a little bit, and I think your book really told this well, about your personal demons. You know, if anybody knows you from right now, they would not have understood what you went through as a little girl. You even were bulimic.
Yeah, and I mean, I think a lot of the stories in the book and part of, you know, why I was compelled to write it and put it out there is because I think people do view a professional athlete as, you know, somebody who is, you know, genetically gifted and has had everything handed to them and is somehow better than all of us. And as you see in the story, and my story is I'm just a normal person, you know, who has had a lot of ups and downs. You know, I have asthma and, you know, grew up without a dad and, you know, struggle with body image issues. And so we're all, you know, we're not that unique. We're all kind of have our insecurities, but that doesn't mean that, you know, you can't push through those and, you know, obviously find success and have a great life and have a great time, despite the fact that a lot of us are sometimes struggling just to get through sometimes.
Yeah, I think we all struggle at one point or another. And there was sort of this defining event for you that put you on the path to being this sort of tenacious, gritty, I'm never going to quit person. Can you relate that? Because whenever we sponsored a rider or a group, we always said, if you're going to put our name on your jersey, you need to respect that name and, you know, cross the line. And you actually have a really good story about not crossing the line.
Yeah, I was a runner in high school. It was where I first found sports and, you know, found all my best friends and, you know, a coach as a mentor. And it was a really important time for me to and kind of change the trajectory of my life, finding sports. But yeah, I was a cross-country runner and one of the better runners on the team. And I think it was my junior year. You know, I was just having a bad day at regionals and I quit. I quit the race and there was nothing wrong with me. I just wasn't up where I thought I should be with the girls that I normally was running with. And so I quit and I walked off the course and was really embarrassed to, you know, the coach and my mom and other teammates came up to me concerned, what's wrong? Are you okay? Are you okay? And I had no answer for them other than that I quit. And that feeling of kind of having to answer to them was something, it made me feel sick to my stomach. You know, I felt like I had let everyone else down. I mean, we barely made the state meet that year because that was a regionals and, you know, taking me out of the scoring really jeopardized actually the success of the whole team. And I didn't think about that at the time. I was just thinking about myself and, oh, I'm not running that well. And, you know, that quitting has stuck with me and that feeling of letting myself and other people down is a pretty powerful, you know, deterrent. And, you know, since then, you know, I've crossed finish lines where they're actually cleaning up the finish line and everyone's gone home. And, you know, but I still will start what I finished, you know, because I just didn't like that feeling of letting myself and everybody else down.
I can remember being at the finish line and applauding for that last person over. And I had as much respect for that person as the person who won the race, if not more, just because
Absolutely.
Of the finish. So
yeah.
You actually did finish your high school, go to college, pursued a business degree, and I guess you joined a gym in Chicago and started rock climbing.
Yeah, I have a marketing degree from University of Illinois, and I, you know, because of my sports, I always thought, oh, okay, I want to somehow use my marketing degree and my sports interest, and, you know, and thought I might manage a health club or do something like that. I never in a million years thought I had the talent or to become a professional athlete. That never even entered my mind, and so I was sort of going down the path of combining sports and business, and so, yeah, I worked at a health club in Chicago, downtown Chicago, and it was a really giant, swanky, fancy health club, and they had a rock climbing wall in there. And I got interested in rock climbing, learned to rock climb, and that really kind of changed everything for me and made me realize it wasn't really the indoor sports that I was passionate about. It was being outside and exploring, and learning to rock climb really has kind of set me on a whole nother trajectory of moving west and becoming a rock climbing guide. And kind of, you know, off on another tangent that was still related, but very different from growing up in the Midwest and, you know, and working out indoors.
I am speaking with Rebecca Rush. She is the, okay, ready? Queen of Pain is her nickname. We'll talk about that later. Her new book is Rush to Glory. I love the name, by the way. I think it's a great name for the book. Adventure, Risk, and Triumph on the Path Less Traveled. Early on in your rock climbing career, set a record. You were the first female to ascend El Capitan.
Yeah, I did, you know, I got really involved in rock climbing, and what was really interesting for rock climbing for me is it wasn't working out just for the sake of working out. You know, I'd see all the people in the health club, and they're just sort of droning away because they have to and because they don't want to be fat, you know, and rock climbing was really, you know, one of the first things that was like, I just wanted to get to the top of the climb. I wasn't thinking about, you know, that it was making my arms strong or what it was, the healthy things it was doing for my body. I was just having fun doing it. So I got really engrossed in it and became a climbing guide. And then I did one of the climbs I did in Yosemite on El Capitan was a route that had only been done once before and no female had ever climbed it. So it was called Bermuda Dunes. I did it with a friend of mine. And we were on the wall for 6 days or 7 days and six nights. So you're basically living up there, hanging like a spider, you know, from the side of from El Cap, and you're sleeping on a portal edge and carrying all of your stuff with you, and your feet are dangling over the edge the whole time. It's pretty exciting.
I think it's pretty terrifying. I guess it's all perspective. So put that in time, because we're going to start moving forward a little bit. But what year was that? Where was that in terms of your life?
Oh, you know, that was 90s is when I was doing a lot of climbing. I was still combining the business with the sports. I was managing a rock climbing gym at the time, and using my business degree, but also using it in the sport that was my new passion. So I was kind of doing the best of both worlds at that time.
You actually opened up your own business, Rockreation.
I was part owner and investor in a chain of rock climbing gyms right when rock climbing gyms were just starting out. You know, it was a brand new sort of cutting edge business. And so I got involved and managed two facilities and helped open the third one. And it was great. It was a dream job.
Yeah, sounds like it. And you had fun. So you kind of moved from rock climbing. I don't think you ever really let it go, but you moved into paddling on an outrigger canoe. First of all, explain what an outrigger canoe is. And then I want you to tell me about these women.
Yeah, I mean, I was living in California, and so, of course, everyone's near the ocean and, you know, meeting people who were, oh, you should come join a paddling team. You should come check this out, you know, because I had strong arms from climbing. And so outrigger canoeing, I'd never heard of it either. It's basically a very traditional Polynesian type of canoe. So these big, long, you know, 800-pound canoes that have sort of an arm off the side that's called the outrigger. And that arm is out there basically so that these vessels are meant for open ocean travel, and so they can take on big waves without tipping over. And so six people fit in a boat, and there was a very good team in California called Offshore Canoe Club that I didn't know at the time, but they're sort of internationally known, and I joined that team and got involved with paddling. And what was really cool about it, it was coming back to what I really loved about the running in high school, was the team camaraderie and working together. And that's the paddling kind of brought me back to that, you know, sitting in the boat with six women and working together, you know, to move that big, heavy boat across the ocean, basically.
800 pounds. That's not what I...
Yeah,
that's heavy.
They're heavy, yeah. Heavy, big boats. But that's what makes them sort of seaworthy. But yeah, it's not a light sort of carbon. I mean, now they're a little more advanced than carbon fiber and those things, but it's a heavy boat to be able to take the waves.
Well, your description of the women, you used the word Amazon. So that tells me they were big women, and yet you didn't feel like you were one of those big women. How tall are you?
You know, I'm 5'7", and I was the tiniest person on the team, you know, even right. though I was pretty built from rock climbing. You know, most of these girls were nearing 6 feet tall. They were a lot of them were firefighters. And yeah, I walked on the beach and just felt like such a pipsqueak.
I'll bet you did. I want to talk about the Eco Challenge and the Eco Challenge team. The preface of your book is written by the producer of Eco Challenge, Mark Burnett, who, if anybody watches a lot of television, he's produced a lot of things, like I think Survivor is one of his shows.
That's right.
Yeah. So you were one of the contestants in Eco Challenge. Explain what the Eco Challenge team was, when that was, and then I want to know about riding camels. I love camels.
Yeah, I mean, Eco Challenges probably was the, you know, the world's first quote-unquote reality TV show, and we, you know, we didn't apply as contestants per se. The teams were actually, you know, you put together your team and you paid an entry fee just like any race, and you went, you know, and did the adventure, basically, the expedition, and Mark made it into a fabulous TV show that was basically showing real people, you know, out in the wilderness of Borneo or, you know, Kyrgyzstan or wherever you are. And the basic premise was getting from point A to point B, which, you know, somewhere around 500 to 800 miles. And you traveled in teams of four, you know, that had to be co-ed, and you did every sort of sport from, you know, paddling, rock climbing, riding camels, bike riding, swimming, and all of it you had to use a map and compass. So you weren't really told where to go. You were just had to hit the dots along the way, and in between you chose your route and your strategy, and the clock never stopped. And so if you slept on the trail, you know, you're eating up time. And so all the competitive teams, you know, we'd be traveling, you know, for 6, 7, 8 days on end with like 2 hours of sleep per night.
Wow.
And so it was quite extreme. It was definitely an expedition, you know, and it made for great television, because as you can imagine, people are lost, they're cold, they're, you know, starting to bicker when they're hungry. And then you throw in all of the different elements of whitewater paddling and mountaineering and everything you can think of in a beautiful foreign country. And it makes for some very exciting television and also a really cool, sport and a way to see the world. And, you know, I was an elite adventure racer for 10 years. So that was a big chunk of my athletic career was going around the world doing those races.
Wow. So how is it to ride a camel?
It's very awkward. it's uncomfortable because the saddles are not really the nice, you know, saddles you think of on a horse. They're just two sticks with a blanket put over them. And they're bumpy and they don't do what you say. And you just got a piece of, you know, twine basically that's tied around the camel's nose, and that's supposed to steer the thing. So it's they're not very domesticated sort of beasts. I was happy to survive that part. So that was in Morocco. You know, we all started on camels on the beach, and it was chaos to say the least.
Yeah, I wonder how they race these things. It seems to me camels have minds of their own, right?
They did. That segment was more survival than race, and we're all just sort of relieved to get to the end and hand the camel back to the, you know, the Berber tribesmen who owned the camels. Like, here, take it. I don't want to see that thing again.
Once again, I'm speaking with Rebecca Rush. Her new book is Rush to Glory, Adventure, Risk, and Triumph on the Path Less Traveled. I guess we should talk about cycling, huh?
Sure.
Okay, so you actually were the reluctant mountain biker, which I
Very
thought was kind of
so.
Interesting. Tell us about that.
You know, mountain biking was part of the whole adventure racing scene, but I only did it because it was, you know, one of the required checkoffs, you know, things you had to do in order to be involved in adventure racing. But I wasn't good at it. I didn't like it. I didn't understand the bikes. It seemed like they always broke. You know, so I couldn't change a flat tire, and technically I wasn't very good. And so during the adventure racing, the cycling parts of adventure racing, you know, I was just kind of trying to get through those sections, you know, paddling, climbing, those were more my forte. But when the sport kind of went off television and the Eco Challenge died and Mark Burnett moved on to Survivor and other things, I was left sort of thinking, okay, well, I guess it's time to get a real job. But I had one more year left with Red Bull. And all they said to me is, you know, find something. We're not going to take the money back. Find something cool to do for the year, and we'll talk after that. And so I kind of went looking around at, okay, there's ultra running. I knew I had a lot of endurance, and that was my forte. But the longest thing I could find was 24-hour mountain biking, which was kind of in its heyday at that time. In early 2000s, and mountain biking was Well, no, no, more like 2004, 2005. But, yeah, it was the longest thing I could find. So, okay, well, I'm not any good at this, but I know I can stay up all night. Like, one night, no big deal, instead of seven nights.
Right.
So I entered my first solo 24-hour mountain bike race, and I ended up beating all the guys. Like, I beat the entire field, even though I was a terrible rider. I had to run over a lot of the technical parts, but I could keep going. And so that kind of sealed the deal that, okay, well, maybe I'll do this for 1 year, and then I'll have to get that regular job. But that launched into a national championship in my first year, a second at Worlds, and, you know, then Red Bull said, well, why don't you just keep going with this and specialize, you know, up the ante. And that was launched, you know, a totally unexpected second part of my career in my worst sport at age 38. So...
And that was 7 years ago.
Yeah, eight years ago.
Okay.
So, it was sort of Phoenix rising from the ashes, I guess, in a way. You know, I thought my athletic career was over, and okay, my last hurrah, and something totally unexpected came out of the woodwork.
In the epilogue of your book, you explain how that is so not true. Over the years in your sports and your careers, you have earned the name of the name Queen of Pain. You measure a 775 in what's called a TSS score. First of all, explain what TSS is and what the average person or even the average athlete might measure compared to you.
You know, yeah, TSS is something that, you know, sort of training websites use, and it's basically just a measure of, you know, the frequency and duration of exercise and the intensity. So it puts together like this sort of little score, taking into account your heart rate and, you know, power meter if you have that and stuff like that. And so it's just a way to kind of categorize when you look at your workouts, okay, this was an easy day, this was a hard day. You know, and I use a coach and use a training system. And so a lot of those numbers are helpful, basically just to see how you're moving along, you know. And so if you went all out for an hour as hard as you could possibly go, that would be a TSS score of 100. So, you know, but most people don't go all out for an hour. So maybe you do 2 hours, but it's sort of medium, you know, that might be 150. And they kind of say generally things over 450 are very high, high-intensity workouts that are going to take you a number of days to recover from.
And there's Rebecca, 775.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a couple really, like, that score was from the Pocatelli Trail that I rode. I went by myself to break the record there, and it was a 13-and-a-half-hour ride, 134 miles nonstop. And, yeah, and I recorded all the data and all the power and, you know, ended up with, you know, clocking in that 775 score at the end of it, which basically just tells me it was a really hard day, which you already know that in your head.
Right, sure.
But sometimes these numbers are a nice way to kind of reinforce, one, that you need a rest day, or two, that you know, you've done a great job and now you can take another rest day, or, you know, to kind of factor in how hard you're working.
It isn't really pain that defines you. Why do you believe you're so tough and resilient?
I think, yeah, I would say I'm more queen of perseverance than queen of pain. You know, I obviously feel pain and as much as the next person. I tend to be able to, sort of push through it a little bit better maybe than the average Joe. But, really, I think it goes back to that high school days. I don't like quitting. I like the feeling of finishing something really, really hard and looking back and going, man, wow, that was really cool, instead of stopping and going, yeah, that was okay. I discover my best self when I push through really hard things. And, you know, you're standing celebrating with people at the end of something like the Leadville Trail 100, and you're all in the same boat. You've all ridden 100 miles, and it's a really addictive feeling at the end of finishing something really hard. So I think I'm more addicted to that than necessarily the pain that comes along with something that's really worthwhile.
Your next adventure has more than just a finish line as a goal. it seems that it's going to bring you full circle, which is what we said right at the beginning of our conversation. You're going to be doing the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which is 800 miles with some elite athletes. Tell us a little bit about the adventure, when it is scheduled, and why it's really important to do it for you.
Yeah, I've been pitching this for a few years to Red Bull, have a goal of riding the Ho Chi Minh Trail, for a few different reasons. One, I've been to Vietnam and it's an amazing country, and it feels like my sort of next trajectory is combining a lot of the adventure racing skills I've learned as far as navigation and, you know, going for days on end, with the cycling. You know, I've been in the Kokopelli Trail was one of those examples of doing, you know, more adventurous stuff on the bike. And so, you know, I came up with the idea to ride the Ho Chi Minh Trail, one, because it's a beautiful place and a very long expedition, but also because, my dad was shot down over there. And his remains were discovered 30 years later, right near the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And so along the way, I would stop and visit his crash site for the first time. And so the trip would be obviously a really physical journey, but an intense emotional journey for me as well. And to just kind of be there at his final resting place and get to know him in the best way I can and kind of spend time where he was.
You know, I was going to ask you other questions, but I think I like the way this just turned out. And so what I want to say is it's an excellent book. Anybody who's interested, it'd be a great gift this season. Rush to Glory, Rebecca Rush with Celine Yeager. I don't know Celine, but I know she has written a lot of other good stuff along with you in this book. Lots of nice pictures. It's Adventure, Risk, and Triumph on the Path Less Traveled. I wish you a lot of good luck. I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me today, and I hope you have a great holiday season.
Thank you. You too.
All right. You take care of yourself.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. Rebecca Rush joined me from her home in Ketchum, Idaho. What a great person. She's just awesome. She's, you know, 45 years old now, and she's done all this stuff I would never even consider doing, and she's still going strong.
Besides the determination and everything else that she has, the give back that she does for the sport, for girls, and for everything else that she
girls,
does.
Girls, she competes with guys, remember?
No, what I'm saying is the give back that she does, yes, for all of the things that she provides for girls, the opportunities and, right, and the camps and everything else that she does is so important. And I'm sure Queen of Pain is nice. It's I put her on the same level as Shut Up Legs.
With Jens.
With Jens, as far as her determination. And
she's awesome, and I really enjoyed talking with her. So that is our show for this evening. Again, we are really not here. I am at the Philly Bike Expo. If you're in Philadelphia or surrounding areas and plan to come to the convention center tomorrow, Sunday, I will be there from 10 to 5. Have a great weekend. Have a great week. If you have an opportunity, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.